Renegade Health Radio.
Renegade Health Radio. This is Kevin Gianni here with Frederick Patenaude. Frederick.
Good afternoon, Kevin.
Good afternoon.
How are you doing?
For those of you out there who don't know, I am writing a book with Hay House. By the way, they are fantastic publishers. I cannot say anything bad about their process. I think it's fantastic. They're great people. I've finished almost all the chapters except for the epilogue, and I am printing out the entire book today, and I'm going to take it to a coffee shop, and I'm not going to leave there for a whole week. Hopefully they'll let me stay for 24 hours straight.
Sounds good. And your book is, I know it's a long process, right? Because you started this process in January 2014.
Yeah.
And then it's going to be released in July of 2015. And we're not even in 2015 yet as we record this. So it's a long process to get a big book published like that.
You know, it's amazing that it takes so long because, you know, we've self-published some books before. We've had editors and we've done all this sort of thing. We've had graphic designers design the covers, like our High Raw book, for instance. And Fred, you've done the same thing. You have plenty of books that you've done too. And it's amazing, like, what the time frame of that is versus the time frame of this. And so it's really remarkable.
Yeah.
But they have lots of books to go through. So
exactly.
No. But I'm excited about it. I think what you're going to find, you know, those of you who are listening now, when this book comes out, I think that you're going to find a very refreshing, informative, interesting book on health. I think you're going to want to read it. I think you're going to enjoy it. What I did in the book, like what I write about in the book, helped me lose almost 35 pounds since January because I had gone through my organic eat whatever I want kind of phase, gained some weight, you know, and finally came back into balance. And it really wasn't that difficult. I think that when you look at what I've done over the last 6 or 7 months or now 8 months is it's not very restrictive. There are certain things that I do, like I switched out my breakfast to only have a green smoothie in the morning. I think that itself might be a very strong, weight loss agent, or a weight loss trick or weight loss hack, if you will. And some other things, I mean, just simply cut back a little bit and I still can enjoy a whole heck of a lot of things. Of course, organic, and of course, you know, highly and properly sourced, but it's not been restrictive. And my hope is that when you read this book, you're going to say, particularly if you want to lose a couple pounds or you just want to be healthy and not have to worry about it anymore, not have to think of like when you're eating your lunch, not thinking about what you're going to eat for dinner. I mean, Fred, I'm sure you've been through this too. Like, it's an endless cycle of like, you know, what food am I going to eat next? This book's going to help with that. So I'm excited to bring it to you eventually. I can't bring it to you now.
Yeah. And for having read parts of it, Kevin, I do agree that it's going to deliver on the promise you just made. So looking forward to that.
Fantastic. Today, we were not talking about the book, though. We're talking about natural hygiene. And we're talking about, I think it's more than just natural hygiene. What we're going to be talking about today is how health myths are propagated. And then, and which ones are wrong. And some we're going to explain some ones that are wrong. And then what that means to you as a reader or a consumer of this information. Does that sound about right, Fred?
Yeah, the mistakes of natural hygiene. And I think that the way to summarize this, to go in a direction that applies to even more health philosophies, is that sometimes the contrarian idea is the right idea. And sometimes we want to be contrarian for being contrarian, but it's not the right idea. So, you know, we could say that, let's say that eating a green smoothie for breakfast is a contrarian idea compared to, let's say, eating the standard, you know, breakfast. And some nutritionists might say, well, you don't have enough protein or you don't have enough of that. But we find that it works and there's lots of reasons in science. And eventually, nutritional knowledge progresses and we realize, yeah, you know, we need more fruits and vegetables and blah, blah, blah. And this is a great breakfast. But sometimes the contrarian idea is partly true, but then partly totally wrong. And then that myth gets perpetrated in this field, you know. So what seems like common knowledge outside of the natural health circle is actually, you know, not believed to be true inside of the natural health circle. So let's talk about that.
Yeah. And let's start. You're much more well-versed in natural hygiene than I am. Why don't you give everyone a definition for those who don't know what it is?
All right. Well, natural hygiene, even though people might not know the term, they most likely have experienced the results in terms of public health policies of early natural hygienists. So people call themselves natural hygienists. It's a movement that started, let's say, 150 years ago in the United States that was inspired by the naturopaths of Europe, mainly in Germany. And those people, initially, they called their therapy, it was nature therapy or hydrotherapy from water. And they had other names like that. And health reformist was another name. And what they did is they went against the common beliefs of medicine at the time, which was, as we know now, completely backwards. You know, people at the time believed that fresh air was wrong, it was bad for your health, and that the sick people with a fever should be locked up inside a room with no circulating air, and then drink no water and drink whiskey to get better, and all kinds of things like that. They thought that bathing was bad for your health. So the early natural hygienists actually spread those concepts of good health through hygienic practices. That's where the name comes from. For example, bathing as being a good thing, and eventually the medical community embracing the idea. But it took them a long time, right, to actually say that we should take a shower or a bath every day, or more or less. So that's how natural hygiene began in 1850, how fasting was rediscovered. And for example, you know, fasting was rediscovered by Dr. Jennings, which is considered like the father of natural hygiene. And he gave people like placebos, so sugar pills, instead of giving them the regular treatment. And people would get better because the treatment was so harmful back in the days. Like, it was actually, you took the treatment and you would die from the treatment because there was no science behind it. So, and then from there, he developed, you know, a practice of fasting. And there were other people like Dr. Kellogg, which you might know from the Kellogg cornflakes, but that was his brother who started this business. But the other brother, John Kellogg, started a center where people ate a healthy diet and fasted and, you know, lived a sober life. Like, there, if you go back to those days, there were actually, you know, lots of diseases that we don't even know today. Like, I think it's the disease of dysentery. Is that the right word in English?
Yeah, sure.
Where it's not a word we use today, but people ate so much food and so much, like, bad food, like big, you know, breakfast full of sausage and then the bacon and just, like, fat and grease all the time, that they would develop these crazy digestive problems, and it was the disease of dysentery. And then they, you know, found, of course, that it was the natural hygiene movement of the time found that it could be solved by just eating a healthy diet and fasting and so on. So that's where natural hygiene comes from. And then later, Dr. Shelton took all of these writings from older natural hygienists and called it he's the one who have coined the term natural hygiene at the beginning of the last century, and then had a fasting center in Texas and wrote a bunch of books and developed this into what we could call a science and an art. So I think natural hygiene had a lot of great ideas in terms of diet and so on. I mean, just the idea of eating more raw foods and eating more fruits and vegetables instead of lots of grains and meat and so on comes from those natural hygienists. So I think, you know, they're really ahead of their time. But as we'll talk about today, some of their beliefs were based on the limited scientific knowledge of the time and are not actually accurate. So those I would call the mistakes of natural hygiene.
I think the most popular natural hygiene literature, if you will, is Fit for Life.
Yeah.
You know, Harvey Diamond's book. And I think when you say that, everyone's like, oh yeah, I get it. I know what it is. And, Harvey Diamond doesn't eat that way anymore. Tony Robbins, who used to teach Fit for Life, has, you know, rescinded his support of it, you know, way back when, saying, you know, I don't know, it was just a phase. I actually saw a video on it recently. I don't know where I came across it, but I think to, before we delve into some of these errors or these mistakes, I want everyone to be, the way I think about this is that we're looking at this to determine what other diet principles are wrong and where can we be more flexible. And I think that this is like the big overriding picture, because, you know, once you get so deep into a theory, you start to, you know, put blinders on and you start to not be open to other options or other opportunities. So for me, you know, when I got bit by a tick, I don't even know if it was 7 or 8 or 5 years ago. It was more than 5 years ago. I don't remember, but I was laying in bed and I felt this like weird kind of like itchiness on my leg. And I looked down and I see this big red rash in a circle. And then right in the middle, there's this little tiny deer tick. And I'm like, oh no, I have Lyme disease. And so I went to the doctor, who's a friend of our, you know, a friend of the family, because I was back in Connecticut. And she was like, here, you know, here's 21 days of doxycycline, which is antibiotics. And this was at a point where I was not open. I had my blinders on. I was into this, like, all natural medicine works, all other, you know, Western medicine doesn't, you know, just split, you know. I still probably felt like if I broke a leg, I'd get a cast or something like that. But so I wasn't that extreme. But, you know, I'm in this like duality kind of mindset. So there's black and white, there's natural, and there's Western medicine. So I get the 21 days of antibiotics, but I leave them on my desk. I don't take them. And I called two natural doctors that I know. Both of them nearly laughed at me. I mean, in a good way, you know what I mean? They were just like, what are you talking about? Like, you, this is Lyme disease. This isn't, you know, this isn't a, I don't even know. It's not like a little, you know, rash on your hand or something like that. I mean, this is a big deal. This could be an entire lifetime of neurological problems. And so I said, oh, okay, you know, that's all right. Well, you know, you could, yeah, trust both you guys. I'll take the 21 days of antibiotics. And you know, the justification, Dr. Williams is one of the doctors that I talked to. The justification was like, hey, you know, what would you rather like to repair, a gut imbalance or again, something that actually is irreparable, which is neurological damage. And so that was pretty easy for me to, you know, to come to terms with. That made a lot of sense to me, even though I was still in this duality. And then this was totally reaffirmed. Anne Marie, I did do the 21 days of antibiotics, but I also did Stephen Buhner's approach, which I believe is Healing Lyme. I believe that's the book. I don't remember exactly right now. But Anne Marie went to go to a natural health store in Connecticut to get some of these herbs. And the guy behind the counter, who was the owner, looked at the herbs and he was like, what are you doing? Because he had known, I mean, he must see people come in all the time with, you know, didn't buy those certain herbs. I mean, there were herbs in a combination that, you know, like people don't normally buy. I remember cat's claw and like, you know, a few other things. Just like, what, you know, like, wait a minute, this is very specific. And so I think Japanese knotweed, and a few other things. And so he's like, look, he's like, I think I know what you're trying to do here. This is for Lyme. And she says, yeah, my husband got bit by a tick, you know, and he literally almost instantly like reached out his hand and he looked at her and he said, look at my hand. He said, I tried a natural approach and his hand was just like shaking. It was literally just, you know, just twitching, you know, he couldn't hold it straight. He's like, I tried a natural approach, you know, 10 years ago. And this is what I'm stuck with. And he was like, tell him to take the antibiotics. So that's what we're going to delve into here. We're going to delve into the reasons why, you know, we have to be a little bit more flexible.
Yeah. This is a good story, Kevin, because I think that's, I mean, you see a lot of people that try, you know, you want to try the natural treatment first, because sometimes the medical treatment does more harm than good, you know, and there are like interesting new research coming out on this, that there's a lot of over-diagnosing going on right now in the medical community. And these are not just like natural health people that are talking about this, like regular medical doctors are talking about this problem. So sometimes you want to do some good and you end up doing some harm. Like you take blood pressure medication when maybe, you know, you had slightly higher blood pressure than most people, but then the benefits of taking the medication, if you're in that range of, you know, you're not that bad, but you're just a little abnormal, is not that great. But the benefit curve rises as you get out of that normal range, right? So I think that's the case with drugs, is sometimes, I mean, yes, they do some harm, but they do a lot more good than harm. And sometimes it's the other way around, you know? So it's knowing when. But usually, I mean, getting the opinion of medical doctors that have also like a strong kind of a natural bias where they will try to use the natural method when they can, but not be religious about it and know when to, you know, when to know the difference is the most important thing. I wanted to just mention like one of the mistakes of natural hygiene, and this is something that I actually believed for a long time, you know. So it has to do with the germ theory. And when I first got into natural hygiene and health, I bought the idea that, the entire theory of disease is wrong, that people mainly get sick because of what they do, right? And this is still true. I mean, people, you know, most diseases are caused by lifestyle. But the germ theory, which is not really a theory anymore. I mean, in science, you use the word theory, like the theory of gravity, but it's a theory, even though it's proven, right? It's still called a theory. So I bought the belief that diseases like the flu essentially were the body's efforts to detoxify itself. And that kind of, you know, I remain with that idea for a while until I noticed that it just wasn't like that, you know. In practice, people got sick because of contagion. And they, of course, if they were healthier, they tended to get sick for not as long, or maybe not catch the virus and so on as quickly or as likely as other people. But it was still caused by something contagious, like a virus, bacterial infection, or something like that. And the final realization came when I hadn't been sick for a while, and of course I was just working on my own, you know, not seeing many people on a daily basis. Like, so I thought, you know, hey, I'm so healthy that I don't get sick, and you know, this whole thing isn't true. People don't get sick. And then I went to a conference where there was like 250 other people, and a lot of people were coughing in a room and so on, and some of those people were supposedly healthy, and then my girlfriend got sick, and then I got sick, and we just were both sick with the flu, essentially. So it just struck me, I just, it's not a coincidence that I just got sick from having, you know, yeah, been around all those people. And usually the people who say they never get sick, they don't have kids, they work from home and so on. So, but when usually people get sick more often are in contact with more people on a regular basis. So we're not going to go into, like, obviously all the reasons why this is true, that you can catch a disease, but it's true. And then mistake number one, or one of the mistakes of natural hygiene, is just claiming that all diseases are just purely caused by diet and lifestyle.
Yeah. And there, I think that what comes from natural hygiene too, is that like healthy people shouldn't get sick. I think that kind of comes from that type of thought process too. Would you agree with that?
Oh yeah. I think that's another one. Healthy people never get sick. Yeah, you do get sick, and people die of something. And everybody who's going to die, unless you die from an accident, death is caused by something breaking down in the body, and it's natural over time as the body gets older that things break down. And I even think that, the reason why healthy people don't, we don't necessarily get cancer as much as other people, has to do with our limited lifespan. I think that if the human being lived 200 years, you'd see a lot more cancer as you go along. And they found this in doing autopsies from people who were supposedly healthy and died at a relatively old age. And they found, hey, there's actually a lot of stuff going on in the body that was wrong, like cancerous tumors and stuff, but it just didn't live long enough for those things to become a problem. That's all, also the problem with the overdiagnosis is often we treat things that would have been a problem much later on down the road. Like there's a lot of research is coming out on prostate cancer that there's just over-treatment of prostate cancer. And it's just most people would die of other things before that even became a problem, and then the treatment becomes more a problem than the disease, So, but things break down and nobody, you look at all these natural health experts, they died of something eventually and usually of the body breaking down in some kind of way. And if you look at how just how evolution works on our planet, why do species evolve is because there's a mutation. And sometimes the mutation is advantageous in the DNA, mutation in DNA. The bear gets a mutation, a black bear, and then it gets a white coat in the great north. And the white, the white furred bears end up having an advantage because they can sneak on their prey, and without them noticing as much. So they live longer, and eventually all of the bears living in the north benefit from that mutation, and then they all become white bears as we know. What they call polar bears as we know them today. But it started from a mutation. But obviously, if mutations can lead to positive evolution, they also have to have the opposite effect. So lots of times people, you're born with a genetic defect and it's not to your advantage, right? In fact, it's the opposite. It's going to lead to your early demise. And I don't think there's a lot we can do against that. We can just try our best to deal with what the cards we've been dealt with from birth. But, it's a dream to think that diet is going to solve everything.
Of course. It's helpful to know. I mean, it's helpful to know your, the genes that you have and the mutations that you have. I've run a full 23andMe report and taken it to LiveWello, which is a site where you can pay to have, I think it's like $19 or something like that, where you can pay to actually have it, analyze it and show you, your detoxification channels, methylation channels, show where these things are somewhat imbalanced or will mutate it. And you can help yourself by eating in a way that maybe steers away from triggering some of those genes. But again, there's some level of like, we do have a finite lifespan. I mean, we will die eventually, right? Every animal does. So that's that point, but you definitely can expand, at least your existing, you can expand or you can improve your existing lifetime. You can expand or you can have a better experience with healthy decisions based on your genes. One thing I did want to talk about before we go is this short-sightedness. Again, I wanted to kind of touch on that again because I don't know if this necessarily comes from natural hygiene, but I know it does because natural hygiene is very, very adamant about the fact of not eating any additional processed oils. So olive oil, coconut oil or any oil that's been extracted from a nut or a fruit, like that. And you, what's really interesting is that you know, as I was diving into the book, and particularly the chapter on sugar, we look at sugar as being this thing that causes diabetes, right? And we say, yeah, you know, lots of sugar causes diabetes. And when I dove deeper into the research, I noticed that it really necessarily wasn't lots of sugar, but it's lots of sugar and lots of fat. Because when you have fat in your bloodstream along with sugar, what happens is that there's, you know, the insulin is doesn't become as active, and it becomes active, but it's not able to find the sugar that well. So your body produces more of it just because the bloodstream is clogged up with fat. And this is really what can cause the overactive pancreas that eventually, you know, causes type 2 diabetes. And it's interesting, like when I look at it that way, and you don't hear many people talking about the combination of the two, you're just like, you know, high fat diet, you know, you can get sick, you can get, heart disease, you can possibly get diabetes. High sugar diet, yeah, you can get diabetes. But when you remove the fat from a higher sugar or a high carb diet, which again is kind of like the natural hygiene kind of approach, you can eat fruit, you eat greens, you have this low fat, I guess you could say, you know, the China study diet, which is 80% carbohydrates, 10% fat, 10% protein. What you get is an anti-diabetes diet, as well as if you switch and you eat more protein, more fat, lots of vegetables, but very little sugar. They both are effective for diabetes, which is really interesting. So the natural hygiene, I think, gets part of it right, but they don't look at the entire other side of the swing, where if you're eating, you know, this other type of diet, which I would say is probably paleo or, you know, kind of in that category, you also can protect yourself from disease, even heart disease, if you're eating, you know, omega-3 rich animal foods.
I agree, Kevin. It's this combination that's deadly, and natural hygiene gets it, you know, partly right when they talk about this, but it's, yeah, there are more ways to arrive at the same destination in terms of, you know, but I, like I've been saying for years, if you're going to eat like a diet with a lot of fruit, like a fruit-based diet, you better make sure you don't eat too much fat, because that combination is what you see in a lot of raw diets where everything is permitted as long as it's raw. So people end up eating, like, you know, they make a lot of juice, and which is sugar. They eat a lot of fruit, which is sugar, dried fruit, sugar. So there's a lot of sugar. And then they also eat lots of nuts, oils. And then this is like this deadly combination where you feel like crap all the time. You don't have energy, and eventually you develop blood sugar imbalances and so on. So I think that's why people who are following a raw food diet are even more adamant about cutting out the fat to create a more successful diet. And I found that if I still eat a lot of fruit, you know, compared to like the average person, but not as much as when I was a raw foodist. So I find that allows me to increase a little bit the amount of fat that I'm eating on a daily basis to maybe like 20-25% of total calories versus 10%. But if I ate more fruit, I would need to reduce the fat and so on. If you know, it's so interesting that you're mentioning that, because that's so true.
It's crazy. And what's interesting is that as I'm diving through the research, the most prominent research that I found about this was like 2011. Yeah. I mean, it's very strange that this is, you know, and I'm sure maybe there's research from before this. I'm sure that people have found this before, but, you know, the easiest to find is 2011, where people are saying, oh, there's a link between the sugar and the fat in the blood with diabetics. And you're just like, yes. I'm like, it makes total sense. You know, and you wonder, you know, these diet extremes, you know, there's two people, you know, on total opposing, viewpoints fighting each other. But they should be like cheering each other on, because they're both fighting disease.
Right? Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Oh man! All right, so high fat, high sugar, watch out for that. Look at your diet today. You know, take a moment to just like say, hey, you know, what am I eating? Am I eating high fat, high sugar? Is this a problem? We'd love to hear, if you are, you know, what you're going to do to, you know, which way you're going to go to get yourself healthier. If you want to, we would love for you guys to also to post a comment on the iTunes site for this podcast. If you like it, if you found anything valuable today, go ahead and post a comment and we'll talk to you next time.
Renegade Health Radio.